Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast, read-through rundown edition. I'm your host, Bridget Flaherty. On October 30th, 2017, the Supreme Court heard argument in Wilson v. Sellers, a case regarding the standard of review federal courts should apply to a final state court denial of habeas relief. In 1996, Marion Wilson Jr. was sentenced to death after being found guilty of a series of violent crimes culminating in the murder of Donovan Parks. At sentencing, Wilson's counsel argued that Wilson was not the trigger man and offered evidence of his troubled childhood. In response, the state prosecutor highlighted Wilson's criminal history and gang activity. Wilson's conviction and sentence were affirmed on direct appeal. Wilson sought habeas relief in state superior court, claiming that his trial counsel offered ineffective assistance in his investigation of mitigation evidence during the trial phase of the murder trial. He offered lay testimony about his childhood and expert testimony regarding his judgment skills. The Superior Court denied habeas relief, concluding that the lay testimony was cumulative of other evidence offered at trial, as well as inadmissible, and that the expert testimony would not have changed the outcome of the trial. In a one-sentence order, the Georgia Supreme Court summarily denied Wilson's subsequent application for a certificate of probable cause to appeal. Wilson then sought habeas relief in federal district court. The district court denied relief, but granted a certificate of appealability on the issue of the effectiveness of Wilson's trial counsel at sentencing. A panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit affirmed the denial of habeas relief, treating the Georgia Supreme Court's summary refusal to grant a certificate of probable cause to appeal as the final state court decision on the merits. The 11th Circuit applied the test outlined by the U.S. Supreme Court in the 2011 case, Harrington v. Richter, asking whether there was any reasonable basis for the Georgia Supreme Court to deny relief. The panel answered that question in the affirmative. Wilson obtained the rehearing en banc before the full 11th Circuit, however, arguing that under the 1991 decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in Yules v. Nunnemaker, the panel should instead have looked through the Georgia Supreme Court's ruling back to the last recent decision by the state's courts. By a vote of 6-5, the 11th Circuit disagreed, holding that federal courts need not look through a summary decision on the merits to review the reasoning of the lower state court. The Supreme Court subsequently granted certiorari to address whether its decision in Harrington v. Richter abrogates this presumption set forth in Yields v. Nunnemaker, that a federal court sitting in habeas proceedings should look through a summary state court ruling to review the last reasoned decision. And now, to discuss the case, we have Lee Rudofsky, Solicitor General of Arkansas.
Wilson v. Sellers is a habeas case, but like many habeas cases that reach the Supreme Court, it is also really a federalism case. Wilson concerns the proper way to apply 28 U.S.C. 2254D, a provision of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, or AEDPA for short. Every party in the Wilson case agrees that 2254D was intended by Congress to force federal courts to accord great deference to state court decisions, denying post-conviction relief. 28 U.S.C. 2254D prevents a federal court from granting relief on any claim that was adjudicated on the merits in state court, unless the state court adjudication of the claim, 1, resulted in a decision that was contrary to or involved in unreasonable application of clearly established federal law, as determined by the Supreme Court of the United States, or 2, resulted in a decision that was based on an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented in the state court proceeding. To understand the dispute at issue in Wilson, it's necessary to briefly discuss three prior Supreme Court cases. First, in Green v. Fisher, decided in 2011, the Supreme Court confirmed that federal courts are supposed to apply the 2254D standard to the last state court's merits adjudication, almost always meaning the highest state court adjudication. No one, certainly not anyone in the Wilson case, questions the propriety of this rule. Second, in Harrington v. Richter, also decided in 2011 and written by Justice Kennedy, the Supreme Court was faced with a summary state court denial of post-conviction relief. That is, a denial without any written reasoning. The Supreme Court explained that in such a case, 2254D prevented relitigation of the merits of the claim in federal court unless every possible ground for the state court decision was unreasonable in light of clearly established federal law. The Richter Court came to this conclusion in large part by analyzing the text of 2254D, emphasizing the provision's focus on the state court decision as opposed to a written opinion. The Richter Court also emphasized the strong federalism and comity concerns that animated 2254D and the intentionally limited nature of federal habeas relief as essentially an emergency backstop for outlier cases. The Richter Court concluded these factors weighed heavily in favor of precluding federal court adjudication so long as any hypothetical ground for the state court's summary denial was reasonable in light of clearly established federal law. Third, in Ilst v. Nunnemaker, decided back in 1991 before AEDPA and the current iteration of 2254D, the Supreme Court addressed a situation that implicated the judge-made doctrine of procedural default. That doctrine held that federal courts would not evaluate the merits of a habeas claim where a state court did not reach the merits of the claim because of a procedural default, like, for example, waiving an appellate issue by not raising it in the trial court. In Ilst, on direct appeal of his murder conviction, a California appellate court found Ilst to have procedurally defaulted a particular argument. When he raised the same argument in state post-conviction proceedings, both the trial-level court and the appellate courts summarily denied his petition without a reasoned decision. Ilst filed a federal habeas petition. Ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court concluded the merits of the claim could not be heard in federal court. The Supreme Court reached this conclusion by creating a rebuttable presumption that the last summary denial of a state post-conviction relief adopted the procedural bar invoked in a previous state court's written opinion. The Supreme Court emphasized it was unlikely that a state appellate court would jump over a procedural default to the merits without explicitly explaining it was doing so. The question in Wilson is how to apply 2254D where there is a lower state court reasoned opinion denying post-conviction relief on the merits, but the higher, and thus last, state court decision denying post-conviction relief is a summary denial without a written opinion. In 1996, the state of Georgia convicted Wilson for murder, among other crimes, and sentenced him to death. Subsequently, Wilson filed a state court habeas petition alleging ineffective assistance of counsel. Wilson argued his counsel did not perform an adequate investigation for mitigating evidence at sentencing. At an evidentiary hearing, Wilson introduced lay testimony of a difficult childhood and expert testimony regarding the genesis of his poor judgment skills. The lower state habeas court denied the state habeas petition, concluding much or all of the lay testimony would have been inadmissible and was in any event cumulative. As for the expert evidence, the court concluded it would not have changed the outcome of the trial. Accordingly, the lower state habeas court concluded that trial counsel was not deficient, and alternatively, that Wilson could not show prejudice. Wilson filed for a certificate of probable cause to appeal to the Georgia Supreme Court. The Georgia Supreme Court will grant such a certificate only if there is, quote-unquote, arguable merit to the petitioner's claim. The Georgia Supreme Court summarily denied Wilson's request. Wilson then filed a federal habeas petition. The federal district court denied relief, but its denial was based on its view that the lower state habeas court's written opinion reasonably applied clearly established federal law. On appeal, a three-judge panel affirmed the denial of federal habeas relief, but did so on different grounds. The panel concluded that the appropriate state decision to review under 2254D was not the lower state habeas court's decision, but the summary denial without an opinion by the Georgia Supreme Court. The three-judge panel thus applied Richter and analyzed whether there was any reasonable basis for the Georgia Supreme Court's denial of relief. It found there was, but relied on grounds somewhat different than those in the lower state habeas court written opinion. The 11th Circuit took the case en banc and in a sharply divided 6-5 decision affirmed the panel's decision that Richter applies and the panel's decision to affirm the denial of habeas relief. The majority opinion was written by Judge Bill Pryor, with dissents from Judges Jill Pryor and Judge Jordan. The dissents argued that the Georgia Supreme Court should be presumed to have adopted the specific reasoning in the lower state court's written opinion. All of the opinions, the majority and both dissents, spent pages upon pages attempting to show that their position was the one that best advanced the values of federalism and comity, with everyone in the case acknowledging the importance of those federalism and comity values to the analysis of 2254D. But perhaps just as importantly, the majority and both dissents pretty candidly acknowledged that they were uncertain whether the Ilst or Richter line of cases should apply. And they both acknowledged that the opposing view could find support in the Supreme Court's prior case law. The opinions also acknowledged a serious circuit split on the issue. And the opinions acknowledged that two Supreme Court justices, Justices Kagan and Ginsburg, have made absolutely clear in previous concurrences from denials of certiorari that they believe Ilst, not Richter, should apply in circumstances like the one in Wilson. It was therefore not particularly surprising that the Supreme Court granted certiorari. Oral argument took place on October 30, 2017. To give away the punchline and engage it a little tea leaf reading, oral argument suggested a court divided on traditional philosophical grounds, with Justice Kennedy's position somewhat difficult to ferret out. However, based on the two questions he did ask at oral argument, I lean slightly to the view that he will join the jurisprudentially conservative wing of the court for a 5-4 victory for Sellers. At oral argument, Wilson was represented by Mark Olive. Mr. Olive argued that the Supreme Court should apply the Ilst presumption and presume the Georgia Supreme Court's summary denial adopted the merits decision of the lower Georgia habeas court. Mr. Olive first attempted to minimize and cabin Richter. He argued that Richter presented essentially a sui generis circumstance where there was absolutely no state court reasoned opinion for the federal court to analyze. Mr. Olive implied that Richter was really a one-time pragmatic decision to avoid de novo review by federal courts and should not be extended to circumstances where there is at least one reasoned opinion issued by some state court. Justice Sotomayor's and Justice Breyer's later questioning of the other side suggests this argument significantly resonated with them. Referring to Richter, Justice Sotomayor even noted, quote, "There was absolutely no reasoned decision anywhere there. We had to do something," close quote. On the applicability of Richter, Justice Kennedy asked Mr. Olive whether there has been any commentary or experiential evidence about whether the Richter rule had proven workable or unworkable since 2011. Mr. Olive could not provide commentary or experiential evidence either way. While the question appeared carefully calculated to avoid signaling how Justice Kennedy would rule, a potential tell was that Justice Sotomayor quickly intervened in this discussion to steer counsel to agree that the Richter rule, by definition, requires more work from federal court judges because they have to consider all possible bases of a state court's denial. This whole exchange left me with the feeling that Justice Sotomayor was working overtime to convince Justice Kennedy that the Richter rule, which he wrote, was causing all sorts of problems and thus should not be extended. In addition to attempting to cabin Richter, Mr. Olive argued that the text of 2254D and the values of federalism and comity counsel in favor of a rebuttable presumption that the last state court's summary denial of post-conviction relief adopted a lower state court's reasoned written opinion. As far as the text of 2254D, Mr. Olive explained that a federal court is supposed to review whether the state adjudication, quote, "involved an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law," close quote, or, quote, "was based on an unreasonable determination of the facts," close quote. Mr. Olive's point is that this language, especially the unreasonable determination of the facts language, seems to require a review of an actual reasoned written opinion, wherever possible. As far as federalism and comity, Mr. Olive argued that those values counsel federal courts not to ignore all the work in a reasoned written lower state court opinion. Mr. Olive argued that it is more of an affront to federalism and comity for federal courts to completely ignore what went on in the state system and come up with their own basis for denial of habeas corpus relief. Justice Alito seemed the most skeptical of this position and asked an incisive line of questioning on it. Justice Alito, actually with an assist from Justice Kennedy and later Justice Gorsuch, posited a state system where the state Supreme Court explicitly noted in every summary denial that it is not necessarily adopting the reasons of the lower state habeas court. Mr. Olive refused to concede that this would automatically defeat the presumption of adoption of a lower court's written opinion. Mr. Olive's answer seemed to concern several justices, likely because it would allow federal courts to affix specific reasoning to the last state court summary denial that the last state court explicitly said it was not necessarily adopting and did not want to be considered to have adopted. Justice Gorsuch asked Mr. Olive an interesting question, one which 25 states had raised in our amicus brief. Would ruling in favor of Wilson actually lead the states to move away from allowing any written opinions from any level of the state judiciary in post-conviction proceeding, so as to be able to rely on the Richter rule? Mr. Olive's answer was essentially that states have lots of different competing reasons for how they structure state post-conviction proceedings, so Mr. Olive did not believe a ruling in Wilson's favor would cause states that currently require written opinions from at least one state court to stop that practice. I'll just say that given my own experiences with state legislatures and state court system, I think Mr. Olive's answer is less than realistic. All in all, Mr. Olive had a good argument and did not seem to lose any votes, but he also did not seem to persuade Justice Kennedy, if, of course, Justice Kennedy needed persuading. Sellers, the warden of the Georgia prison system, was represented at oral argument by Georgia Solicitor General Sarah Hawkins Warren, who, for full disclosure purposes, I'll note as my good friend and colleague with whom I work closely. Distilled to its essence, General Warren's position is twofold. First, that nothing in the text of 2254D suggests federal courts need to or should presume the meaning of a summary denial by the Georgia Supreme Court. General Warren argues that Richter's interpretation of the text of 2254D confirms this reading. Second, having federal courts presume a summary denial by the Georgia Supreme Court necessarily adopts the specific written reasoning of a lower court is offensive to the values of federalism and comity, particularly since federal circuit courts and the Supreme Court are not presumed to adopt the reasoning of federal district courts when they issue summary affirmances. The rule should at the very least be the same for both systems. General Warren argued that this case is basically no different from Richter, where the relevant state court decision denying post-conviction relief is not accompanied by a reasoned decision. General Warren argued that the rule from Richter should thus apply, where federal courts would not review the merits of a claim unless every possible ground upon which the state court denial could have been made constitutes an unreasonable decision in light of clearly established federal law. From the start of her argument, General Warren faced skeptical questioning from Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and Breyer. She did a solid job of standing up to and mitigating the potential damage from this incoming rapid fire. Justice Kagan asked what I thought amounted to the most difficult question of the day. Justice Kagan asked whether General Warren's reading of 2254D, as only focusing on the decision as opposed to the written reasoning of the last state court, meant that federal courts should apply the Richter rule even when the last state court adjudication includes a written opinion. Essentially, would a federal habeas court still have to look to all possible bases on which the last state court could have theoretically rejected the claim and decide if any hypothetical basis for denial was reasonable? General Warren acknowledged that where the last state court decision includes specific reasoning, 2254D provides a textual basis for federal courts to analyze solely that written reasoning as opposed to other hypothetical reasons to deny relief. But General Warren explained that doesn't textually require or suggest federal courts should presume a reason for denial from the last state court if the last state court chose not to provide a reason. Otherwise, Richter's analysis of 2254D could not stand. Justice Ginsburg, for her part, seemed to concentrate on an amicus brief from former justices of the Georgia Supreme Court. In that brief, several former justices argued that the practice in Georgia is for the Georgia Supreme Court to always issue a written opinion if they disagree with the reasoning of the lower court. So in light of this practice, Justice Ginsburg, and actually Justices Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor, wondered what would be wrong with presuming a summary denial from the Georgia Supreme Court adopted the reasoning of the lower state habeas court. Solicitor General Warren explained that there is no state law or state court rule requiring the Georgia Supreme Court to issue a written opinion just because they disagree with the lower court's reasoning but agree with the result. It may happen sometimes, it may even happen often, but there's no evidence suggesting it happens all the time. The former justice's brief is at best anecdotal, according to Solicitor General Warren. While her answers did not seem to convince Justices Kagan, Ginsburg, Breyer, or Sotomayor, they did seem to at least marginalize this state-specific quirk for the other justices. Moreover, as a question from Justice Gorsuch to Mr. Olive in rebuttal suggested, the court is going to have to fashion a rule that can be applied to all states, and thus will probably shy away from relying on the anecdotal suggestion of a particular, non-required practice in Georgia. In my view, one of the two most insightful exchanges of the argument was when Justice Kagan asked Solicitor General Warren why a state Supreme Court would not explicitly say it disagreed with a lower court reasoning if it thought that the lower court's reasoning was unreasonable in light of clearly established federal law. General Warren flipped the question around, rhetorically pondering why a federal court should presume that the highest state court would sub silentio adopt the specific reasoning of a lower court that was clearly unreasonable in light of established federal law. Isn't it more consistent with federalism and comedy, Solicitor General Warren pondered, to assume that the highest state court did not sub silentio adopt an opinion that was clearly unreasonable? The other really important exchange was when Justice Sotomayor asked Solicitor General Warren what the point of state post-conviction proceedings would be if Georgia's position prevailed. Why not, asked Justice Sotomayor, simply assume the denial of state post-conviction relief and proceed directly to federal habeas proceedings? Solicitor General Warren explained that the state habeas process is still important. For one thing, whereas lower state court provides a reasoned written opinion, that may well be, as a practical matter, the first basis for denial that the federal court examines. Nothing suggests the federal court's 2254D analysis shouldn't start there. It just can't end there. Second, although General Warren did not say this, the primary importance of the state habeas process is that relief might actually be granted there. As Richter explained, the state habeas process is supposed to be the quote-unquote main event in post-conviction proceedings, with federal habeas relief acting simply as an emergency backstop. Justice Sotomayor's question suggests her view that state habeas proceedings are simply the warm-up act to federal proceedings, which is 180 degrees from the views expressed by Justice Kennedy in his majority opinion in Richter. Whatever the ultimate outcome is for this case, I wouldn't hold my breath for a quick decision. I expect a sharply divided court with one or more very strong dissents.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.